Welcome to the deep dive. Okay, here's something to think about right off the bat. Could our economy, like the way it's set up right now, actually be a major cause of health problems around the world?
That's a heavy question. We're diving into Unraveling the Fabric of Fear again, and today it's chapter 14, and the title gives you a clue. The Consumerist Cycle, Public Health Issues. Pretty intense stuff.
And if you've been following along with our previous deep dives, you remember we talked about fear and self-worth and curiosity. Mm-hmm. All those ideas kind of weave into this chapter too. So our goal today is pretty straightforward. We want to pull out the main arguments about how this consumerist cycle hits our health.
Right.
So the chapter starts by taking us way, way back, like Neolithic Revolution back.
Mm-hmm. From hunting and gathering to farming.
Seems like ancient history, I know. But the argument is that this shift really set the stage for, well, a lot of what we deal with today.
And what's really interesting there is how society fundamentally changed. Hunter-gatherer groups, the chapter suggests, mostly had these gift economies.
Gift economies.
Yeah, like based on sharing, reciprocity, built on trust. Pretty equal, relatively speaking. The whole idea of owning stuff individually, property rights, that wasn't really the main focus.
Huh. So the idea that something is mine, that might be a relatively newer concept, historically speaking.
That's the core insight, yeah.
Yeah.
That our whole concept of mine could be tangled up in some of these big systemic problems.
Right. Imagine a world where resources kind of flow, focused on the group, not just stacking things up for yourself. And the chapter points out this ownership idea, this mine thing, actually came before a lot of the big religions.
Exactly. And the argument follows that once you have ownership, well, then you get the potential for wanting what others have. Jealousy. Covetousness.
Okay. If there's no mine, maybe you don't feel that same urge for someone else's thing. We kind of touched on jealousy back in chapter 5, didn't we?
We did. Looked at the roots of it. And it builds from there in this chapter 2. The source also really emphasizes how controlling land, controlling food, that directly became social status. Respect.
Okay. So resources was the original social capital, literally. The book argues this created a real attachment, almost, it says, an addiction to owning things. That's topic 12, right? Because it felt good. It boosted your self-worth. That's topic 4 again. Success became less about the group, more about my pile, often gotten through, well, force. And this, the source suggests, conditioned a mindset of changing the world taking stuff rather than changing your own needs or lifestyle. That ties into topic 1.
So it's not just survival, it's identity tied up in what you possess.
Mm-hmm.
And the source traces this right up to today, like intellectual property patents.
Yeah, it draws that line from ancient land rights to modern patents. And here's where it gets, well, really controversial, according to the source. It argues that patents, which were meant to spark innovation, right, are now often slowing it down and even critically making public health problems last longer. For profit.
Wow, okay, that's a huge claim. What examples does the book give?
Well, it mentions these things called non-practicing entities, NPEs. Patent trolls is the common term.
Right.
The source cites a Washington Post piece calling them a modern-day mafia. They don't make anything. They just buy patents to sue actual innovators. It puts a chill on things.
Okay, so weaponizing the system.
Exactly. And then there's the Time magazine report it references about AIDS drugs. It highlights how big drug companies and governments, especially U.S., fought hard to enforce patents, which kept prices incredibly high in poor countries, even while people were dying in huge numbers.
That's tough to hear.
It is. But the source contrasts this with places like India, Argentina, Turkey. They apparently built up their own pharma industries, making affordable drugs, partly because they didn't grant patents on essential medicines in the same way.
So the argument in the book is that the patent system, for meds anyway, has kind of flipped from public good to protecting profits, even if it costs lives.
That's the case the chapter makes, yeah. That it's become this tool for financial gain that can actively block solutions to health crises.
Okay, so moving from ownership and patents, the chapter then looks at how societies with really big wealth gaps stay stable. It calls it the art of being managed.
Yeah, the source notes that historically, if the gap gets too wide, too obvious, the people managing things, the ones at the top, they become targets. Social unrest, you know.
Makes sense. People get frustrated if it feels totally unfair.
Right. So how do you stop that? The source suggests one way is just adding more layers to the hierarchy, creating more steps between the bottom and the absolute top. Class fragmentation, it calls it.
Like more middle management rungs on the ladder.
Kind of. Blurs the lines, maybe. And the book mentions other tools, too. Laws, obviously fear of punishment and just, well, physical distance. Keeping the very rich and very poor separate so the gap isn't so visible. Ignorance helps maintain things.
So the basic idea the source puts forward is the bigger the visible gap, the more you need fear and ignorance to keep things stable.
That's the uncomfortable logic it presents. And this fine scientific art it talks about, that's finding ways to actually increase the gap safely. By getting the people being managed to, well, to almost want it, to participate willingly.
Okay, hold on. How does that work? How do people grant permission to be managed?
The source draws a direct line here and says, we do it by consuming, by buying the products and services from the corporations, the entities that benefit from the current system. Your purchase, the book argues, is like a vote. You're implicitly saying yes to the system, giving permission for these companies to have power.
This sounds like the law of permission again, topic 13 from earlier deep dives. Just paying attention lets them try to convince us their product boosts our self-worth.
Exactly. And why do we pay attention? Why are we drawn to buy stuff? The source says it's our deep need for social value. We want to belong, be respected, fit in.
Our brains see being different from the group as an error.
Yeah, it references research suggesting that, which makes us, you know, vulnerable to marketing, to political messaging. Marketing's whole game, the source argues, is convincing us this product gives you social status. It makes you part of the in-group.
I remember it mentioning Robert Sapolsky saying advertising isn't about making you feel poor. It's about making you feel inadequate compared to some ideal.
Yes, exactly. And in this setup, money becomes the main visible scorecard for social value. The book connects income disparity directly to self-worth disparity. It even cites research suggesting our brains process social approval in the same reward areas as money. Like, we literally value social standing in monetary terms.
So money and belonging are kind of wired together. That explains a lot about consumer culture. So sellers need to keep persuading us to give them social value by buying things. That's the consumerism engine the source describes.
And it's a feedback loop, right? You buy something, you get a little psychological kick, maybe you feel better about yourself, more accepted. That reinforces the behavior. The source argues this can lead to a kind of addiction to spending, consumption addiction, linked directly to chasing that social value and self-worth.
So the system kind of hijacks our social needs and our desire for self-worth to keep itself going, keep us consuming, keep us basically consenting.
And the results, as the chapter lays out in the next section, they're devastating. Which brings us to the public health issues part.
Right, let's connect those dots. The book argues capitalism, with its focus on competition, naturally fuels consumer competition. We're always comparing ourselves, striving, often through what we own.
And this competition, built into the system, the source says it inevitably creates and deepens class divisions. And from that follows poverty. That's topic 11 territory.
So, what does this mean for people's health? Poverty, whether it's absolute, like not having basics, or relative, like just the stress of feeling left behind, unequal to source, says it creates deadly health risks and affects thinking, cognitive function too.
And maybe surprisingly, the source also points to a lack of empathy potentially being correlated with the other end of the wealth scale.
The link between inequality and actual physical health seems really stark in the chapter. It's presented not just as correlation, but as a direct risk factor for strokes, cancer, heart disease.
Oh, absolutely. The source uses some really strong language. It quotes Dr. Samuel Broder, former head of the National Cancer Institute, calling poverty a carcinogen.
A carcinogen? Wow.
Yeah. It mentions stroke death rates being much higher in low-income countries. Studies showing lower socioeconomic status ups your chance of heart disease by like 50%. The source flat out says class itself is a public health problem.
And it's mental health too, right? Linked to status, poverty, addiction.
Definitely. It cites an APA study linking things like unemployment, poverty, housing problems to higher risks of mental illness. It references Bruce Levine's work connecting suicide, depression, crime to poverty. And those Wilkinson and Pickett findings are really striking. Across developed countries, as economic inequality goes up, so do all sorts of social and health problems. Mental illness, addiction, obesity, even violence and prison rates.
And didn't the source mention something about minimum wage?
Yes. Research suggesting that even a small increase in minimum wage was linked to a drop in suicide rates. and longer lifespans for the poorest group. It suggests that these aren't abstract economic numbers, they translate directly into life and death.
So that's the impact at the lower end. What about the other side, the empathy thing?
The source points to studies suggesting, maybe counterintuitively, that greater wealth can sometimes correlate with less compassion. It mentions the having less, giving more study.
Oh yeah, what did that find?
It found that people with lower incomes actually gave away a significantly higher percentage of their money to charity than wealthier people did.
Huh, interesting. And the impact on kids' brains, that sounded awful.
It's really concerning. The source cites studies linking poverty to cognitive issues, even changes in brain structure in children. One study suggested the constant stress of money worries could reduce cognitive capacity by the equivalent of, like, 13 IQ points.
13 points.
Yeah, the cognitive load is immense. So pulling all this together, the source builds this really powerful and frankly very disturbing argument. It claims the world's biggest killer isn't just disease or war viewed in isolation, it's what it calls structural violence. And it says modern capitalism is the primary driver because of the deep inequality it creates.
Structural violence.
Yeah. It even quotes a statistic suggesting millions, maybe up to 18 million unnecessary deaths each year because of this inequality. Dr. James Gilligan is quoted comparing the scale of this loss of life to an ongoing genocide or even nuclear war.
That is just staggering. A really profound charge against the way things are structured. So before we finish up with chapter 14, it's probably worth quickly touching on the religious or spiritual perspectives the chapter mentions. The introduction to the whole book flagged this, right?
Yeah, the point that many of these patterns aren't new discoveries. Wisdom traditions saw them centuries ago before science could, quote unquote, prove them. The references aren't endorsing religion, just noting these older observations.
And you definitely see echoes in this chapter. Christianity, for example, warning against serving money, finding happiness just in wealth, exploiting people. Islam warning against hoarding wealth, thinking it makes you immortal.
Buddhism, too, with deigna generosity to counter greed, which it calls lobha, a poison causing suffering. Hinduism has similar ideas about deigna, charity, and lobha, greed, being obstacles.
Even those other texts it mentions, the Emerald Tablets, talking about needing freedom from desire for real freedom.
Yeah, the common thread across all these very different traditions seems to be this deep caution about chasing material wealth, about attachment, about greed. It really resonates with the chapter's findings on the downsides of the consumer cycle and linking self-worth to possessions.
It really shows these are deep human issues, not just modern economic ones.
Yeah.
Things people have wrestled with for ages.
And now, the source argues, modern science is providing the hard data on just how damaging these systems, driven by those impulses, can be to public health and well-being.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So the big question then is, can it be changed?
Well, interestingly, the chapter itself is quite clear. It explicitly says it's not offering direct solutions within its own pages.
But it does talk about tools, right? Ways to approach this.
It does. It talks about using unconditionally compassionate curiosity and adopting the holistic perspective that the whole essay tries to offer. It says these approaches, supported by both ancient wisdom and modern science, are our best tools, even unavoidable if we want things like abundance and harmony. We need to shift from fear to curiosity, because the source implies if we stay stuck in fear, then the competition and the scarcity mindset that caused these problems will just continue.
The chapter also points towards Peter Joseph's book, The New Human Rights Movement, for a deeper dive into the modern economy critique.
And something called the Humania Project for ideas about rethinking culture and economy.
Right. Place to continue the dive.
Exactly.
This has been quite a deep dive. From the dawn of ownership through how consumerism works, right into this idea of systemic structural violence impacting public health, and seeing those echoes in ancient thought too.
It definitely highlights how complex it all is and underlines that call from the source for, you know, curiosity, a holistic view, trying to understand the whole system.
Absolutely. Well, that wraps up our exploration of chapter 14. Just one chapter left in Unraveling the Fabric of Fear.
The final one, The Law of Free Will. That should be interesting, a big topic to end on.
It definitely is. So maybe something to ponder until then. When you feel that urge to consume or you notice those wealth gaps, is the system working? Or are we seeing what the source calls structural violence play out?
And if you want to explore these interconnected ideas further, you can check out the Cathartic Curiosity Project and their website.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.
Yeah, thanks for tuning in.
Stay smiling, stay curious, and keep diving even deeper for the final episode. Free will. Till next time.